If you appreciate this Issues Etc. Classic and other shows throughout the year, please consider making a year-end tax-deductible donation today. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make a financial contribution by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind at the end of the year.
Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're coming to you live this Epiphany Sunday evening. And apropos of the season and of the celebration, we're going to be talking about the text that usually occupies much of the church's contemplation and the characters that occupy that story in Matthew's second chapter. They're called the Magi, they're called the Wise Men, and around these three men, or perhaps we should better say around the child to whom they travel and before whom they bow, swirls an awful lot of ancient history and interesting material. The star that appears and guides them to the baby Jesus, or was he a baby? Do these three men, these three wise men, if there were three, belong in the nativity scene? Who were they? What about King Herod? Was he as bad as Matthew makes him out to be? Dr. Paul Meyer is professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, and a regular guest here on Issues Etc. Dr. Meyer, welcome back.
Good to be back with you, Todd.
Probably as we're speaking, my wife is finishing up the dismantling of our nativity scene under our Christmas tree. It comes down right after Epiphany. And the wise men are in there. They're kind of arriving at the scene as Jesus has just been born. Do the wise men belong in the nativity scene?
Actually not, Todd, although we're not asking people to throw their olive wood creches away. You can have the Magi kneeling next to the shepherds if you'd like. You're simply telescoping the events of the Nativity. As a matter of fact, even the film, the Nativity Story, does that at the last scene where the shepherds come in first and the Magi arrive the same night. Not really possible. The Magi couldn't have arrived until about 40 days after the Nativity. Not much longer than after that, but it would have been at least 40 days. How do we know 40? Because Joseph and Mary present Jesus at the temple in Jerusalem on day 40 after his birth. They would not have done that if there was an all-points bulletin from Herod warning about babies in the Bethlehem area. So we're quite sure that this is separated by a little over a month. And by this time, the Holy Family are living in a house. They're no longer in a cave or grotto or cavern as they had been the night of the Nativity. But again, we can cut the motion picture producers some slack in the sense that you have to very often telescope these things to make them all fit on the screen within 2 hours.
Who were these Magi, these wise men? What do we know about them?
Well, tradition says one was white, one was black, one was yellow. Traditional names are associated with the Melchior, Gaspar, and Balthazar, but these are all late traditions. We don't even know, of course, if there were three. All we know, there were two or more, and that they came from the east. And, well, John Chrysostom, for example, thought there were 12, maybe getting the number from the 12 disciples. But there could have been three under the assumption that we have three gifts given and one gift, one giver. And so the traditional three, I suppose, is hung on.
The skeptic who is kind of in the know on these things surrounding the story of Christmas, Christ's birth, might notice that the story of the Magi and the events that spin off from their arrival is only found in one gospel, Matthew's gospel. And they might say, look, this is too convenient a story. If you want to make the point that this baby is the king of the Jews and the coming Messiah, you introduce kind of Deus ex machina these wise men to verify the fact. How would you respond to that?
Well, you can say the same thing about Luke. He's the only one mentioning the shepherds. I mean, a single source itself doesn't mean that the event never happened. Clearly, we all wish we had more detail on the Nativity, on every aspect of Jesus' life. Why don't we have more detail? Well, it seems that the gospel writers have one scroll, you know, in which to communicate the good news, and Mark and John find Jesus' adult ministry so very important they don't even begin with the nativity. Eusebius tells us that John didn't because he knew that the nativity had already been written down by Matthew and Luke. But for this reason, simply because you have one source alone doesn't mean the thing didn't happen. The idea that we have Matthew here trying to glorify some astral event and so forth, I know that charge has been leveled against him. Matthew is the one who tells us about the star, about the earthquake at the time of Good Friday and so on. But again, what if these things really happened? And indeed they did. And so I don't think we can fault Matthew for that reason.
Were these philosophers? Were they astronomers?
Well, the Magi are well known in the history of Babylonia and Persia. They were very much like the Levite tribe among the Jews. You recall the Levites were a sacred tribe among the Jews to take care of spiritual matters. And so these Magi also were the professional people of the time. These were the scholars, the university professors, the teachers, the philosophers, those who were specialists in law, medicine, theology, religion, comparative religion, astronomy, astrology. They were the great teachers of antiquity in the Middle East. And so they're very well known. And again, not the three or more in the case of the Nativity account, but as a cast, as a group, they were well known.
Why would they have been watching the stars?
Well, let's wind the clock back 2,000 years ago. You don't have many city lights piercing the darkness. People went to bed after sundown in the ancient world, got up early. You have awfully clear air there. There's no pollution from factories and whatever else. And so every night there was an incredible spangle of stars overhead. It would have been so impressive, I think, in the ancient world to have viewed the night sky. And so naturally people are, if not starstruck, they become authorities in astronomy.
And the star is what catches their attention. They seem to be able to, for some reason, understand its significance. How would you explain the conclusion which they draw from observing this, at least it appears to be, new heavenly light?
Again, Matthew, I think if he would have had patronage and would have had an unlimited number of scrolls available to him, like Flavius Josephus did, for example. We all know about Josephus, the first century Jewish historian. He was adopted out by the Roman imperial family of the Flavians. We're talking Vespasian, Titus, Domitian, people like this. And so he had unlimited space in which to record this enormously meticulous history of the Jewish people. Matthew didn't have that luxury, and for this reason, you know, he might have given us a whole book on how the Magi found out about this. He might have given us far more detail on the nature of that star. But he's got just a chapter, you know, to tell of the nativity, and so we just don't have all the details. Again, the star itself has been the subject, you know, of much theological and scientific discussion. There are really two avenues to get back to that star. The one avenue is don't try to explain it. This is a supernatural sign sent by God. It's therefore beyond all natural explanation. The other explanation says, hold it. God could have used an astral event of some kind to bring off his good news to the Gentile world. And I think Christians ought to be broad-minded enough to accept either category of explanation. Now, if it's a supernatural sign sent by God, I can't explain it further. I mean, there's just no way to explain it. But if you want an astral event that could have been used by God, well then, you know, just look in the newspapers a week before Christmas every year. There's always a new theory from some astronomer somewhere, especially someone who has friends in the Associated Press, I guess. And they all come out to desperately trying to get some event in the sky around 1 BC or 0 or 1 AD. And that, of course, just doesn't work because we know for a fact that Jesus was born sometime between June and December of 5 BC. Again, don't blame him for bad timing. 5 years B.C. before himself. This was an error made by the later monk in the 6th century who got us onto the new calendar system of B.C. A.D.
Let's talk about that on the other side of the break, because that may be the best way for Christians to equip themselves to respond to erroneous explanations for what was going on when that star appeared to these wise men. We're talking about the Magi tonight on Issues Etc. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Next week on Issues Etc., we're going to discuss the doctrine of justification with Dr. Rod Rosenblatt of the White Horse Inn. We hold that one is justified by faith, apart from works of the law. Now, what does that mean? And why did Luther call this teaching the doctrine by which the church stands or falls? We'll talk about that next week on Issues Etc. with Rod Rosenblatt. Now, if you'd like to know what we'll be discussing for the rest of January, click the upcoming shows section of our website, issuesetc.org. While you're there, be sure to find out more about an international relief agency that's concerned with both body and soul, LCMS World Relief. You can look for their logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or you can donate to LCMS World Relief by calling 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438, a Christ-centered, cross-focused relief agency. Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. Dr. Meyer, you mentioned right before the break that Jesus was, in fact, by our slightly misguided reckoning of the years, born in 5 BC. To the question of the star that so many people are perplexed by, are there any likely astronomical events that fit the bill for 5 BC or thereabouts?
I think Johannes Kepler had the best idea of all. He was a Lutheran astronomer in Prague back in the 1600s, and he saw something in the night sky which is just spectacular. It's a very rare phenomenon. It's called the triple conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn, three times those two brightest stars in the sky, so to speak, those planets almost impinge on one another. A very rare phenomenon. It happens every 800 years. It happened at the time of the first Christmas, happened in 800, happened again in 1600 when Kepler saw it. Will not come again until 2400 A.D., so we'll never see it. But it would be quite spectacular, those two coming together almost three times. Just imagine, in a very starry night in July, look out over in the night sky if you're away from the city, and you see many, many stars overhead, but one or two will be very bright. Those are not stars at all. They're planets. We're talking Jupiter or Saturn or Venus. Sometimes Mars is pretty bright. Now imagine two of those brightest lights almost touching one another. That would be spectacular. We'll never see it, but the Magi did. And I think this comes as close as any to giving a natural explanation for what may have happened about the time of Jesus' birth, because this triple conjunction happened about 765 B.C., and that would be about right in terms of Herod killing the babies 2 years old and under, according to when the star appeared to the Magi. Again, I'm not trying to say this is now the perfect solution for the star of Bethlehem, but it does show that there were things happening at the time in the Near East which could have alerted them.
1-800-730-2727 is our call-in numbers. We're talking with Dr. Paul Meyer tonight about the Magi and their story. Our email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's talk with Tony, who listens in Chicago on WYLL. Hi, Tony.
How are you doing?
Very well.
I want to say, first of all, hi, Dr. Paul. I have a lot of friends who attended Western Michigan and enjoyed you.
Oh, thank you.
I've read a lot about Isaac Newton and his interest in the Bible, and he had a lot to say about this astrological phenomenon that you mentioned that Kepler noticed in his time. Do you know anything about Isaac Newton's theology or his astrology and biblical knowledge?
Well, everyone tries to adopt Isaac Newton for his own purposes. Even agnostics sometimes say he was only a deist, but that's wrong. We have a lot of evidence that Isaac Newton was a pretty definite Christian. He, of course, was a tremendous scientist in so many different areas. And he, above all, saw that you simply can't have a creation like this without a creator. And so much of his work was simply to identify God's great creation after the fact. And for that reason, his laws, of course, you know, are so very impressive, showing the order of the universe, which could only have come from an original architect.
Dr. Meyer, the next character, if you will, that we meet in this story in Matthew's Gospel is Herod. They visit, the Magi visit Herod. Is Herod as bad a character, according to secular history, as Matthew seems to make him out to be when he includes him in his story?
Todd, it all depends on what era in Herod's life you're talking about. If you're talking about his younger age or his middle age, I think this unusual personality has every right to the title Herod the Great. He couldn't stop doing enough building in the Holy Land. He kept a precarious peace between the Romans and the Jews, built the great temple in Jerusalem, and did a lot of enormous things over there. But he married too often, 10 wives concurrently. Each of those wives produced princes, each of the princes scheming to succeed and be number one, turning the house of Herod into something of a can of worms. The two or three collateral plots were taking place in Herod's household before they had orange juice in the morning. I mean, it was just a rat race there. And this kind of addled Herod so much so that he executed three of his own sons on suspicion of treason. He killed his favorite wife, the beautiful Hasmonean Maccabean princess, Mariamne. He killed his mother-in-law, killed an uncle, several cousins. He invited the high priest down to a swimming party at the Winter Palace in Jericho, and he drowned him, you know, played a very rough game of water polo. And so, yes, he's a very murderous character in his old age.
And with only about a minute and a half here before the break, to jump ahead a little in the story, Herod, as you mentioned before, puts out an all-points bulletin on baby boys because he fears for his own throne. What was the scope of the slaughter of the innocents? About a minute and a half.
Well, it's been exaggerated, of course. In the medieval era, there's one book that suggests there were 40,000 babies killed. It's just ridiculous. I did an actuarial study on Bethlehem, which is about 1,000, village of 1,500 or so, and there would have been only about two dozen babies 2 years old and under, half of them the wrong sex. And so for that reason, we don't hear a lot about the slaughter of the innocents outside Matthew. And I wouldn't expect to, simply because infant mortality was so high in the first place in the ancient world.
Was Herod threatened by Jesus' birth?
Not at all, because Jesus was a spiritual king. But Herod didn't know that, didn't understand it, should have tried to figure out what was going on.
We're talking with Dr. Paul Meyer tonight on Issues Etc. The subject is the wise men and the story that Matthew tells us surrounding Jesus' birth. You can read several articles written by our guest, Dr. Paul Meyer, on our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you're going to find these articles, including one titled, The Guests, Local Shepherds, Distant Magi. Our website address, issuesetc.org.
Folks, the gospel is free, but producing this show isn't. Please consider making a year-end, tax-deductible donation to Issues Etc. today.
We're talking about the Magi. Dr. Paul Meyer is our guest. Jeff writes this from McKinney, Texas. How had the Magi come into contact with the Hebrew Scriptures, and how were they able to understand the Messianic prophecies better than even the Hebrew scholars of the time? Was there a widespread literacy of the Holy Texts at that time? Good question. Thank you for the email, Jeff. Dr. Meyer.
I'd say it's a very good question. As a matter of fact, it's so good a question that I had to write a whole big article in the Lutheran Witness in the January issue just exactly a year ago. How could these Magi ever have figured out that a star is going to be the heralding sign of the Messiah? What about the Messiah? How would they have known about that? And a lot of skeptics, you know, jump in here and simply say, oh, come on, this is impossible. It's part of Matthew's mythology. This couldn't happen. Well, hold it. Everybody forgets about 586 B.C. when King Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem, burned the temple, and took the leaders of the Jewish people, the rabbis, the scholars, the professional people, into the famous, infamous Babylonian captivity. And everybody thinks that, oh, well, then Cyrus released them and everybody came back under Ezra. Not true. Many Jews stayed on in Babylon for the next 1,000 years. We know this because the Babylonian Talmud, that great collection of Jewish writings, was finally edited in the city of Babylon, 400 A.D. So, you know, for the next 1,000 years, there would be Jews living in Babylon, and certainly at the time of the first Christmas. So the point I'm saying is that these magi, who were specialists in comparative religion, would have been very apt to have talked to their Jewish colleagues across the street in Babylon and found out their prophetic predictions about the Messiah, the Messianic star, the importance of it. They also would have known the prophecies in connection with the book of Numbers. And so really, you have here all the parameters you need in terms of the Magi being theologically skilled enough to ask a question like this.
It says in verse 11 of the second chapter of Matthew, there on coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him, and they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Give us, if you would, kind of the catalog explanation of these gifts, and why does Matthew include this detail, in your opinion?
Okay, gold, I think, is quite obvious. This would be their American Express traveler's check, so to speak, for the flight to Egypt. Obviously, traveling is expensive. Where are they going to get the money? And in this case, this would be where? Then you have the frankincense, which is an aromatic incense used in worship of all kinds. And this, some have said, betokens Jesus' role as a priest, prophet, priest, and king. King is gold. Myrrh is, I should say, the frankincense is the priestly function. And myrrh is an aromatic salve which was used in burial practices, as a matter of fact. So here you have, right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, kind of a symbolic interpretation ahead of time of what's going to come at the end of his ministry. Jesus was buried on Good Friday, you recall, with myrrh and aloes. And the women came, of course, on Easter Sunday morning to complete the job. But so you have here various aspects of Jesus' life betokened ahead of time.
It says twice there in Matthew's telling of it that they go to worship him. First they say, we have come to worship him. And then it says that they actually do worship him in that verse I just read. Is this homage? Is this worship as men now believing in Jesus as the Messiah of the world?
This is what Matthew seems to suggest to us. And again, if these magi were very well skilled in Old Testament prophecies, there's no reason why they shouldn't be doing this. We don't have all the detail. We just have the highlights in Matthew's gospel. Again, if Matthew had more resources at his disposal, he could have written a whole book, perhaps, on how the magi found out about the Nativity in the first place. We just have a limited account here, but that doesn't mean it's false.
Byron in Houston writes, something that has always bothered me about this story of Herod killing the babies is why and how would babies threaten his kingship? How old was Herod at the time of their killing? After all the time, a baby was old enough to usurp his kingdom. Would he still have been king anyway, or was he protecting his own offspring's right to the future throne?
Well, Herod in his old age was very paranoid by this time. And he had a good reason to be paranoid. Look at the incredible can of worms that was his household. You have sons who were trying to assassinate their father. You have brothers trying to kill brothers in order to be able to succeed. Now, he found out from the priests in Jerusalem on the basis of the prophecy of Micah that the messianic figure would be born in Bethlehem. And that must have shocked Herod, because he probably would have thought that the usurper to the throne, as he might have termed him, was a full-term adult. But now it's a baby, huh? Okay, well, let's terminate this right at the start. This is the reason why he becomes very murderous and orders the infant massacre.
Byron, I'm going to send you a copy of In the Fullness of Time. Thank you very much for emailing us with your question. If you would, email us back, issuesetc@kfuo.org, with your mailing address. I'm going to send you In the Fullness of Time. Dr. Meyer, Jesus seems to be coming off in this story, although he is mentioned only as the child. He seems to be coming off in Matthew's telling of the story as fitting the Old Testament bill for the Messiah, by everyone's accounts, perfectly. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, there's no question that he did, and this is what I deem the tragedy of Orthodox Jewish women to the present day yet. It's true that they are still looking for a physical person who is the Messiah. And every Jewish mother who's of the Orthodox brand of Judaism wonders, if she has a boy baby, is this the Messiah? Is this the Messianic figure? And what's so sad and pathetic about that is that no one, again, could ever fulfill all the aspects of prophecy which Jesus did. And so you're not going to be able to, you know, reiterate all this unless Jesus goes through it again. And so it's just so sad, again, that they're still looking for the Messiah when the Messiah showed up, fulfilling all those prophecies in detail 2,000 years ago.
So kind of stepping back from Matthew's account of this thing, we have the very king of the Jews, Herod, if you would, sitting on his throne, getting the message via these messengers from the east, the Messiah has been born. His council of priests, the high priests, are able to conclude that this is a likely scenario. And it's all confirmed there. What is Matthew telling us?
Well, Herod was troubled and all Jerusalem with him, which is a very neat way to put it. Matthew is right on target there because everybody's used to Herod's fits of rage. They're worried about him. They're worried about what he might do. And so if Herod is in turmoil because of this, it's going to rile the whole city. There's no question about that. His throne is at stake, Herod's fate. And by the way, you know, you can't blame him entirely. I don't think these magi had gone to any schools of diplomacy because look at their question. They come to Jerusalem and they say, "Where is the newborn king of the Jews, you lame duck?" Yeah, you know, where's the prince who's going to succeed you any day now, you has been?
And we've come not to see you, but we've come to see him.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you just don't want to mess with Herod toward the end of his life now. He's in his upper 60s, and at this point he's afflicted with a medical encyclopedic series of diseases. I think he has everything from cancer to gonorrhea by this time, and his mind is going as well. And so this is just, he becomes the monster of the Christmas story or late in life.
Their lack of diplomacy notwithstanding, do you think the Magi are simply going to what they considered to be the most likely place to find the Messiah when they visit Herod in his palace?
Well, yes, I think it's very important that they made that mistake going to Jerusalem rather than directly to Bethlehem. With the skeptics, I would say that if they went directly to Bethlehem, that would just be too much. They see in the stars and through Jewish prophecies that the Messiah is going to be born, the King of the Jews. Well, okay, that's got to be in the capital city. So they make the logical error, and they go to Jerusalem first, which is very credible, very realistic. So I'm really glad they made that mistake.
This is really kind of, if you were writing a screenplay of this, this is a pretty intricate twist of plot lines, isn't it?
Certainly is. That's why in the Nativity story, did you see it?
Not yet.
Oh, you got to see it. Yeah, Mike Rich did a good job, but I mean, he had it all laid out for himself in terms of Matthew and Luke. And it's a wonderful example of Hollywood finally not screwing up a good story.
I want to get Dr. Meyer's review of the Nativity story to get a chance to see it, and I think his review counts for something. When we come back from this break, 10 more minutes in this first hour with Dr. Paul Meyer talking about the Magi. He's professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. He's authored numerous books, including In the Fullness of Time.
We need to hear from each and every one of you. Please support this worldwide outreach with a year-end tax-deductible donation today.
I'm Todd Wilkin, and this is Issues Etc. We're back with you live this Sunday night, January the 7th. Our guest is Dr. Paul Meyer of Western Michigan University. Dr. Meyer, what did you think about the film that came out right before the holidays, The Nativity Story?
Well, I thought for once it was just delightful to see Hollywood not messing up a plot. Very often when they have an ancient setting for a film, it's a case of rewriting history. It's a case of an imbalanced presentation. But this time, Mike Rich, the screenplay writer, who is a Christian himself, I think was very faithful to both Matthew and Luke in the presentation. I found very little to criticize, except, of course, the last scene where you have Jesus born, the shepherds come, and then the Magi the same night. We discussed this earlier. That would have been impossible. But again, I think we can forgive the producers because you have to telescope events in a film anyway. And by the way, so many Christians across the world celebrate that telescoping by having a creche with the Magi kneeling next to the shepherds.
And did you watch it with the historian's eye for those details that perhaps only an historian might notice?
Oh, yes, they certainly did. There were several errors, but nothing big. They go down the wrong side of the Sea of Galilee when they're on the way to Jerusalem, for example. They wouldn't have gone up these high mountains and across desert sand dunes and so forth. They probably took the water level route from Nazareth. They'd go down to the plain of Jezreel, then over to the southern end of the Sea of Galilee, turn right, go down the Jordan River Valley to Jericho, turn right again, and go up to Jerusalem, turn left, and about 5 miles south of that would be Bethlehem. So there weren't all these, but again, it was spectacular scenery, so I guess we can forgive Hollywood for doing that, too.
Why are sometimes these magi, we've talked about them as philosophers, astronomers, and you said the scholars or the professors of comparative religion, why do they sometimes, are they hailed as kings?
Well, this, I think, is due to that wonderful American Christmas carol, We Three Kings of Orient Are. It's a lovely song. It's made three mistakes in the first line. That's not bad. Well, maybe not. If there were three magi, then there's only two mistakes. But to say they come from the Orient, that's the old version, including the Middle East. The Orient to us today sounds China, Japan, India, and so forth. But as a matter of fact, the American Oriental Institute still deals with Middle Eastern matters, and so that old definition is hung on. They were not kings, no. That's simply wrong. They were these magi who had sometimes kind of a royal aura about them, and the people regarded them with the same kind of favor they would kings, perhaps. So we can forgive the author of the American Christmas Carol.
Listening to us on the other side of the planet in Japan, Kate writes, if the Magi knew Jesus was born to be a king, and they were warned in a dream about Herod, why didn't the Magi take the family, or at least the child Jesus, with them away from the murderous Herod? They do just seem to kind of make a hasty exit.
They were warned, perhaps, on the way back to Jerusalem after they'd left the Holy Family. You can't tell when they were warned to go back a different way. That's one slight difference also in the film. They have the good hunch that they shouldn't go back to Herod, whereas there is an angelic intervention, according to Matthew. But again, this is something we can forgive Hollywood for. Jesus is specifically directed to go into Egypt by the angelic messenger. I should say Joseph is. And so that's why they're going in that direction. It makes every sense in the world to go to Egypt rather than Mesopotamia, because Mesopotamia, we're talking, you know, a month, month and a half, two-month trip, whereas Egypt was only 5-6 days away.
And how long would the Holy Family have been, I guess, hiding out in Egypt before the death of Herod and the return and on up to Nazareth?
It all depends on when the Magi visited. If it was pretty near the Nativity, I really think they came not much more than 40 days after the Nativity. You know, they're not going to be there 2 years, by the way. There are so many people make that mistake. They think that Jesus and the family were there 2 years and they go back to Nazareth then with Jesus as a toddler and so on. I don't think that's right at all, simply because we don't have a lot of resources in the Holy Family. Is it less expensive to stay at home or to go on the road? You know, it's much more expensive to go on the road to live away from home. So I really don't think they could have been there 2 years. It would have been a case of whatever happened during January, February, and March of 4 B.C. Herod dies about April 1st of 4 B.C. So if Jesus is born toward the end of the year 5 B.C., and you have the 40-day lapse, it's not going to be too long that they're in Egypt.
So they may have only been there a matter of weeks or even months.
Oh, I think so. I'm sure it was not more than weeks.
And why do they return to Nazareth instead of going back where they seem to have had at least temporarily set up some housekeeping in Joseph's ancestral city of Bethlehem?
Well, they probably did stop at Bethlehem on the way back. But then they got the local news that Archelaus is in charge, and he was no a benevolent ruler by any means, let me tell you, because he inaugurated his reign with the execution of 3,000 Jews who were demonstrating in front of the palace. So I think they, again, there are going to be some weeks until Archelaus settles in, but by this time he was accumulating a pretty bad track record. And so they could have stopped for some time, I don't know, weeks or so, even in Bethlehem before going back to Nazareth.
He goes back to Nazareth, and Matthew gives us a very brief reference to the Old Testament. He will be called a Nazarene. And this leads to some confusion later in Jesus' ministry as to whether or not he has the messianic credentials, doesn't it?
Yes, except for his birth in Bethlehem. I mean, that will guarantee it for him. It's interesting that so many of the critics who try to tear down the Nativity account try to say that Jesus was born in Nazareth and not Bethlehem. That seems to be such high fashion among radical revisionist critics, and it's really kind of pathetic. If there were any evidence whatever that Jesus was born in Nazareth and not in Bethlehem, I would check it out, and I would say there is a problem here. But we don't have any reference to Jesus being born anywhere else than Bethlehem. So I just have never understood this criticism. The only argument they use is the crucifixion itself, where on the cross it says Jesus of Nazareth, not Jesus of Bethlehem. But I think it's a stupid argument in the sense that Jesus is born in Bethlehem. He spends, he never visited there again except on the way back from Egypt. He spends his entire babyhood, infancy, youth, early adulthood in Nazareth, and they should be call him Jesus from Bethlehem? You know, give me a break.
It is interesting that it is at the cross that Jesus is called a Nazarene. Already at the very beginning of Matthew's gospel, as he walks us through a very intriguing story of these men who come from afar, having observed a sign in the heavens about a new king born to the Jews. Already, Matthew is pointing us forward to why this child, Jesus, is born. And what does it mean that he is born a king? Dr. Meyer said earlier, Herod had no reason to fear this baby because this baby's kingship, his kingdom, is not of this world, just as he says before he goes to the cross to pay for the sins of the whole world. My kingdom is not of this world. What is his kingdom? His kingdom is his righteousness, his forgiveness, his word, his sacraments, as the life that he lived for us and the life that he gave for us at the cross is given to us through his word and through his sacraments. That is the kind of king this Jesus is. That is why he came into the world. That is why he is heralded by angels, a savior from sin, a savior for sinners like you and me, who is Christ the Lord. That is why he is visited by men from afar who, although no one else seems to know, they recognize and worship him as the savior from sin that he is, Jesus Christ, crucified and risen from the dead. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc.
If you appreciate this Issues Etc. classic and other shows throughout the year, please consider making a year-end tax-deductible donation today. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make a financial contribution by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind at the end of the year.